You're listening to El Clásico, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España, from Barcelona to Madrid. Today we're at La Cruz de Linares.
You are indeed listening to El Clásico. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this episode and I am on La Cruz de Linares, where today the Vuelta a España was mercifully spared by the mysterious Nubero, the Asturian god of clouds and storms, who according to local legends frequently wreaks havoc in this part of the Cordillera Cantábrica, that's the Cantabrian Mountains. Unmistakable in his goat leathers and wide-brimmed hat, Nubero is said to delight in striking animals with bolts of lightning, ravaging crops with hail, and cruelly denying loyal domestiques a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to win grand tours with devastating attacks in the closing kilometres of decisive mountain stages. Slightly economical with the truth on that last point, perhaps. However, also in Asturias today, but not with me here on La Cruz de Linares, is our good friend, voice of cycling, Eurosport commentator, Rob Hatch. Rob, where exactly in Asturias, but not at the race, are you?
I'm in that wonderful big working class city that is Gijón, right on the coast.
Any sightings of Nubero there?
No, not Orbayu either. That's the Asturian slang, by the way, for that fine rain that soaks you through. So it wasn't spitting, thankfully, today, was it? It's been an absolutely glorious day up here.
Rob, are you familiar with Nubero? Apparently it's
no,
a big thing.
No, I'm not
thing.
Familiar with Nubero.
It's a,
is it?
Yeah, it's a big thing in Asturias, apparently.
I mean, that last word I mentioned, Orbayu, is something that's graffitied onto almost every motorway bridge up here. It's bizarre. And when I asked the question, apparently it is just slang for drizzle. So it's a very unique thing. And obviously they're very attached to the weather here.
The Basques have a lovely word for a sort of light, drizzly sort of haze called sirimiri. You see it. It's the name of a lot of sort of restaurants and taverns and that kind of thing. Anyway, Rob, we really should talk about some cycling. I said we'd been spared the ire of Nubero, and the race had been spared storms of any description today, including maybe, possibly, the kind of storm that we experienced. Some of us, in some cases, enjoyed last night. The storm brewing in the Jumbo-Visma camp after the stage to the Alto de Langliru, won by Primoz Roglic, and well, followed by controversy, wasn't it, Rob? Just quickly, before we get on to today's proceedings, I presume you watched yesterday's stage, Rob, and we'll talk a lot more about it and about the postscript later in the episode, but I've cranked up the super what did Lionel call it, the hot take machine, to super caliente, and
yes.
And yeah, I'd like your quick, very very sizzling hot take on yesterday, please.
I don't think it's too caliente anymore because it's cooled off over the last 24 hours, but I think it was pretty much unanimous feeling, wasn't it, for most people? I don't think I've ever seen as many ex-pros, current pros, people around, observers, journalists, all being pretty much unanimous agreement that it was an absolute horror show from a PR stand yesterday from Jumbo-Visma. I do not know what they were playing at, and I very much enjoyed my good mate Sean Kelly just tearing the whole idea and any defence of what happened yesterday to pieces. And when he says it like that, you know there's a problem.
Rob, traditionally, at this point in the episode, or not at this point in the episode, but any point in the episode when we begin to talk about and think about the power struggle at Jumbo-Visma, we hear this. Yes, Rob, because I think it would be remiss of us to proceed to the tale of the Etapa without hearing a little bit about what happened this morning in a little place called Pola de Allande. That was where the start was taking place. And obviously it was a hot topic, what happened last night. And we were keen to get the views or get the sort of post-race, towards post, sort of morning after reaction rather, of some of the protagonists, particularly Primoz Roglic was in demand, didn't speak, I don't believe, at the start this morning. But yesterday, before yesterday's start, we'd had a word with Richard Plugger, the Jumbo-Visma director sportif, sorry, not director sportif, what am I saying, team manager, He's the team manager. He's the Grand Fromage.
He's the big boss.
And what I forgot to point out yesterday was during his interview, you heard it clearly on the podcast, but in the background was the sound of a chainsaw. Which was pretty ominous with hindsight. I wish I had mentioned that now. But we heard from him yesterday, and he sort of outlined how key to the team's process and how they were going to tackle things, and how they always tackle things, is communication. And, well, we saw some dubious communication after the stage on the Angliru yesterday. Richard Plugger emerged from the bus shortly after it parked up today at the top of a sort of a long and quite steep hill, and he was pursued by the most of the fairly small press pack that's here at the Vuelta a España, sort of down a country lane. But he did front up and he did answer some questions this morning. So we're going to hear from him, and then we're going to hear from Sepp Kuss, who, well, see what you all think. I think in this interview we can detect a new sort of edge, or we could detect this morning a new edge in Sepp Kuss's voice. So here's Richard Plugger first, and then Sepp Kuss.
That you guys are in, what did you talk about last night? Both Sepp and Mark said that you were going to talk about the situation last night.
Yeah, we are in indeed a very good situation, and something that never happened before. So it's not a textbook solution for this, and we need everybody, like always, to discuss. So, and what we always do during the races, we evaluate the stage, we evaluate how we can go further, and we did that last night as well. And you will see it today.
So you can't tell us the conclusion?
No, like I said, you will see it today. But it's really important that we have a plan as a team, as we always do. Talking a lot, I'm telling this often. We talk a lot in the wintertime. We talk a lot during races. We want everybody to give their opinion. Everything needs to be on the table, and we want to know what everybody's opinion is, and then we can make a plan. And now we have a plan.
Richard, specifically yesterday, Jonas followed Primoz. Probably difficult to make the decision in the heat of the moment, but was that a mistake? Because it's taken him so close that it's created a lot of questions, and it almost feels as though he's breathing down Sepp's neck now.
No, I think, yesterday was yesterday, and I think we did a good job, like I said just now. We are happy with the results yesterday. Again, it was a brutal climb. Things can happen. Big things can happen there. So we needed to be sharp, because the big goal ultimately is to be to win the Vuelta. And that's more or less what's it.
Those discussions last night, don't expect you to tell us everything that was said, but the general mood, was it a heated discussion, forthright discussion, or was it all very harmonious? And
it's a discussion, so sometimes it's people are trying to bring their point of view to the table, but that's how we work, that's what we want. And you have to have a discussion with that and try to find a middle ground there, and that we succeed in that, because we always succeed in that. That's why we are so successful, that Sam and Winne, again, winning together. We can only win a race if you work really well together.
I was in this unique position, of course not by accident, but by a situation in the race and by racing, but I felt like I've deserved this position. I've ridden in the echelons. I've ridden the best time trial of my life. Yesterday we did the Angliru, I don't know, third, fourth fastest time ever. So I think I've deserved that. And I know that that I deserve the support of the team behind me. And I'm never the guy that puts his hand up and wants everything this way or that way. But from what I've learned is that you have to stick up for yourself.
So Rob, fascinating, I thought, there to hear Sepp Kuss sort of talk about why he deserved to win this Vuelta a España. And Sepp Kuss he's famously self-effacing, has been self-effacing throughout his whole career, has been self-effacing throughout this Vuelta a España. Yesterday, after the stage to the Angliru, he said, I'll probably never be in this position again. I got the strong sense this morning that either before the meeting that Jumbo-Visma had, or in the intervening hours before this morning, someone had got in his ear and given him a bit of a pep talk and said, Sepp, you deserve well, you certainly deserve to win this Vuelta a España for this reason, and various other reasons, which he sort of enumerated for us this morning. That was my sort of strong sense. And when he said, sometimes you have to stand up for yourself, I mean, I'm not going to say that that was the equivalent of the line in Succession from Roman to the other siblings, stop ganging up on me like you're Lennon and McCartney, and I'm George, I'm John. But I think someone had given him a bit of a pep talk, Rob. That was my reading of those comments.
First things first, you're spoiling Succession for me. I think I've only got about 5 episodes in, and then I've got to go and dig out, and you're ruining the plot line. But I mean, if it's anything like what we've seen in the Jumbo-Visma camp, then I'm certainly going to watch it anyway, because it's been entertaining, you know, even looking on and being sort of aghast at what we've seen on the road and wondering what's happened off the road. I'm in complete agreement there, though, Daniel, that somebody has had a word, thankfully, with Sepkus to show him his worth. And again, perhaps he does know his worth. You know, there's got to be a certain amount of confidence in there that he can do his job. You know, he's been up there, he's got results to prove it. He's won big Grand Tour stages in most of the main races. Yes, it's about time he started standing up. And just, I hope that somebody has said that, you know, this is a unique opportunity, and you'd be pretty silly to not put that point across. Certainly in a team like Jumbo-Visma that's running a, you know, the sort of Dutch straight-talking fashion, as you'd already alluded to, Daniel. And if you can't say it in Jumbo-Visma in a Dutch team, then you're not really going to be able to speak up anywhere, are you? The idea is to say things and nobody gets offended in that sort of culture. It's part of the team's culture and part of the culture in the nation itself. So I'm glad he's done that. And there did seem to be a change in what he said. I picked up on another sort of word that he said earlier on, and he actually mentioned that he was altruistic, rather quite altruistic. And it was an interview he gave at the start line today. And that was something new for me. He was, you know, and that for me came into a sort of a quote that had been fed into his mind by whoever was having the pep talk, and saying, well, you know, look, you're a great guy, you're a nice guy, but you're here because you're a bloody good bike rider as well. And look what you did for Roglic when he was swinging on that end of that stage in the Giro. Look what you did in the Tour when Vingegaard was having a bad day. You know, these guys owe you this. And it was nice to see him coming out and defending himself.
Incidentally, Jonas Vingegaard also sort of reiterated what he'd said, even if his deeds on the Angliru didn't necessarily match his words. But what he'd said last night on the Angliru, namely he wanted Sepkus to win the Vuelta a España, he reiterated that at the start this morning. He also sort of hinted to our colleagues at Danish TV, or more than hinted, he said that he hadn't necessarily been in agreement with this best man wins policy all along. He'd been in favour of them picking a man and backing that man. Richard Plugger, on the other hand, Rob, told us we would find out what they had decided in today's stage. Now, did we find out what they had decided? Rob, you're going to give us today's tale of the etapa.
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Well, actions speak louder than words, don't they? And 178.9 kilometres to the Cruz de Linares, not once but twice, a loop around the brand new first category finish, right in the heart of Asturias, not too far from Oviedo. Plenty of climbing, and a few sports directors who'd done the recon around here said that this was actually going to be the hardest stage of the Vuelta. The scene was set, the sunshine was out, and the paraíso natural, that is the Principality of Asturias, showed its beauty. The cider apple orchards and green pastures on the slopes of its harsh mountains, leaving a beautiful view as the peloton passed by. But they weren't just passing by, they were flying by again. Another big, fast start. 14 riders up the road at one stage, almost 12 minutes of a maximum gap as well. But once we got to the business end of things, that was reduced, as was the size of the group. Remco Evenepoel had secured the King of the Mountains jersey, winning points. Yes, again, he was in the break. And as long as he stays in his bike all the way to Madrid, he will be the man that takes home that polka dot jersey. When we got to the first of the two ascents of the Cruz de Linares, Andreas Kron was the man who forced the early pace. That did for people like Egan Bernal, who was also in a breakaway. Only Remco Evenepoel could follow, Damiano Caruso, and young Max Poole from DSM as well. Kron, though, showed that he'd given a bit too much too early, and he was soon out as they were down to three. Behind all eyes, of course, as we've been talking about since the start of the episode, we're on Jumbo-Visma. The peloton, also headed to the final two climbs, just over 10 minutes behind. Yet again, it was Bahrain victorious who decided to take the pace up in that group. Remco Evenepoel, in the meantime, at the front, dropped Caruso near the top of the first ascent, and Poel followed suit. Remco Evenepoel was alone with 29 kilometres to go, and it looked as though it was going to be another Evenepoel exploit. First time through the finish, Evenepoel had over a minute on the closest chase of Poel and over 10 minutes on the red jersey group. Evenepoel then extended his lead on the descent and on the flat, Poel and Caruso regrouping on that section before the second and final ascent to Cruz de Linares. A brand new climb, but one with gradients up to 16% at stages, a little bit of concrete with sort of grooves put in there to help the rainwater. The surface was horrible in parts, but the scenery, as we already said, was stunning. Evenepoel had over 2 minutes and was riding away to that third stage victory as he started the final climb. In the main group, as we switched our attention behind, Landa attacked, but it didn't work. Yes, that's Landismo too, as we know. It's not all about success. All eyes were on if a Jumbo Mikel would Landa. Follow.
Mikel Landa could conceivably have won the Vuelta a España yesterday for Sepp Kuss. So, you know, all you detractors, all you heathens who don't believe in Landismo, Mikel Landa, Vuelta a España winner, possibly, come Sunday. Anyway, go on, Rob.
Esto también es Landismo, Daniel. It's alive, as you said yesterday. He did try, it didn't work. Jumbo, they tried to follow. They followed well, actually, but they followed as a unit. There was nothing doing in the drama stakes. Landa would try again, but apart from a quick Ayuso reaction, there was pretty much unanimity between the killer bees, sticking together, presumably after that overnight telling off from the queen bee, whether that had been on the bus. Vingegaard was riding on the front, clearly working for Kuss. Roglic on his wheel, Kuss in red and sitting behind. But then this strange sort of tension descended on the group. Camera fixed on a group of no more than six riders. Mas was there alongside Landa and Ayuso as well. And a real tense wait over the final 3 kilometres as they rode to the finish. Nothing happened until 1K to go, but under the kite, you knew something was coming. Ayuso attacked. Kuss then followed and looked stunningly, stunningly brilliant again. No hint of a weakness like there'd been the day before. But soon as Kuss started forcing at the front, Vingegaard was on the radio and Kuss seemingly quickly lifted his foot. What a difference a day makes, and what a difference a gesture from somebody else makes. The games, though, restarted in the final 500 metres. Kuss this time following another move from Ayuso. Landa in it too, before he started to be distanced. A small gap to Vingegaard that was filled by Roglic. In the end, stage, of course, won by Evenepoel, but all the drama behind, not maybe as much as we might have been expecting, anticipating 24 hours ago when it was all kicking off again. In the end, 9 seconds lost by Vingegaard, who came in just behind the group. Some might have suggested he sat up to calm things down. Whatever happens now in the GC, it's 17 seconds between first and second. Some breathing room and a day closer to Madrid. Not quite no worries yet, Daniel, but less worries. I think as you and our mate Roglic would say, sweet worries, huh?
We are enjoying, huh? Maybe we are not enjoying as we will hear in just a minute. Rob, that was a splendid Telly Etapa. You should do this for a living, I would suggest. Talk about bike races. Really tremendous stuff. Rob, in the gripping battle, just the gripping battle for fourth place. I'm just looking at general classification. Micro movements.
I think there was, 3 seconds lost by Landa as he couldn't follow that final acceleration in the end, same as Vingegaard. In the end, it was Ayuso, Mas, Kuss and Roglic coming to the line, 9 minutes 29 behind the winner, Evenepoel. Mikel Landa at 9.32, Vingegaard at 9.38. And I must say, given it was a busy tail of the Etapa, let's just give the podium on the day there their dues. It was Caruso second at 4 minutes 44. They were never really in it. That's why we didn't go into it. And Andreas Krohn just about meeting Max Poel for third on the day. In the GC, Daniel, you've got Kuss, Vingegaard and Roglic. 17 seconds, as I said, from first to second. 108 now to Roglic from first That is just less than a minute now from Vingegaard to Roglic. Ayuso still fourth. He's at 4 minutes. Landa in that Spanish duel. In fact, it's three of them, isn't it, fighting out for fourth place there because Mass is just behind. Ayuso at 4 minutes.
Has anyone called it the Spanish Civil War yet?
Oh, I don't think we should go there given the current political scene in Spain, Daniel. Probably wouldn't be the best idea. But yeah, I'll keep that one quiet if I were you on top of that mountain with all the reporters around at the minute. But it's 19 seconds from fourth to fifth. Ayuso to Landa. Landa's at 4:19. It's half a minute still from Ayuso to Enric Mas, who's at 4:30. And Erk de Brooks is seventh at 7:37. Vlasov, his teammate, at 8:35 in eighth. Almeida being Almeida again at 10:20 in ninth. And Buitrago's just about in the top 10, Daniel, 12 minutes 20 down.
Well, Rob, there we have it. No explicit hostility between the Jumbo-Visma riders, certainly on the road today. Very much a harmonious team performance. And there was a bit of conflict on the road involving Jumbo-Visma, involving one of their soigneurs, a German soigneur, and the Guardia Civil. They were sort of, I wouldn't say going at it, but there were a few disagreements throughout the afternoon. And, that culminated in the Jumbo-Visma soigneur being knocked to the floor around about the time when the race was finishing. Very unsavoury scenes there, Rob. But let's hear from a few of the protagonists today, shall we? Let's hear first from Remco Evenepoel, the stage winner. We're going to hear secondly from Sepp Kuss. And, well, I said there was no conflict, no over conflict on the road between the Jumbo-Visma riders today. But have a listen to the interview that comes after Sepp Kuss. And this was given to me again after the finish today. And it's from Primoz Roglic.
I mean, I already mentioned it before. I did a recon of this stage, so I knew what was coming and I knew what to expect and I knew what to do. And I knew that it was 35K with both of the climb seat of Cruz de Linares inside. So if you feel that the legs are super on the first time, you should just go for it. And then I think that's what I did. And in the end, yeah, 3K before the finish when it flattened out a bit. Ilio Keise told me in the car to slow a bit down because the gap was super big, so I could kind of enjoy and relax a bit. And that's what I did. And I think it was maybe it's the most beautiful of the three victories that I took in this Vuelta. First goal was to secure the mountain jersey, and then when we got a gap of 10 minutes, we quickly knew that it was going to be for the stage as well. I felt that the legs were getting better and better, actually. I mean, better and better. I felt that I could hold on the high powers like I could in the beginning of the race. So I think, it was just one of those days. Where I could do whatever I wanted, and that's how the victory came.
Yeah, it's super cool to be in the wheel of the Tour champion, the three-time Vuelta champion, Giro champion, sitting in front of you, and it's also a bit of extra pressure because I have to hold the wheel. But it was really, really special. Yeah, I trusted in the guys to help me, and there was no doubting in my mind that they would do that. For me, the only relief was just being able to follow through, because you can say, yeah, we're going to do this and that, but I also have to have the legs to finish. It wasn't an easy stage, and I had to stay super focused, believe in myself, and make it to the finish line.
Was it also a part of the team plan to gain a little more cushion over Jonas?
Yeah, I mean, it never hurts. But yeah, I also know Jonas that he wouldn't try and do anything. But it's always better to have a bit of cushion in case I lose 17 seconds in a sprint finish. You never know.
Primoz, you got a bit of criticism yesterday for the interview. How did it make you feel when you saw the way people had reacted to the interview you gave yesterday?
Yeah, I don't know.
When people said you should just be riding for Sepp and you shouldn't have any other thoughts, any other ideas, what did you feel?
Yeah, I mean, everyone has their own opinions. I mean, including myself. I don't really care much.
And in the meeting last night, so it was decided that Sepp was going to, well, hopefully win the Vuelta and everyone was going to ride for Sepp.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, our bosses said in the evening that the GC should be the way it is. So we try to keep it like that.
How did you feel about that?
I have my personal thoughts about it, but I will work for it. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, Rob, welcome back after the break. I think we needed a break after those comments from Primoz Roglic. I have now retreated to the press room, or descended to the press room. And the press room where, well, there's a world first today because there's a DJ at the press buffet. The press buffet, which is still going on. You can maybe hear the DJ in the background or the tunes that he's laying down. That is, as I said, without precedent, I think, in the world of press buffets. No Ritmo de la Vuelta today, but, well, there's a kind of ad hoc Ritmo de la Vuelta being supplied by the DJ here in a place called, I think it's called Proaza, where we are, just at the foot of the final climb. Rob, what about Rog? What about Rog? What about those comments? Well, let me just explain that. So ordinarily, most people who watch now on GCN in particular, GCN are very good at sort of showing what happens, and they stay on air for quite a long time after the finish, and you'll have seen the sort of bundles around riders, and we all sort of stick our microphones in, and everyone gets pretty much the same quote usually, from the main stars at least, after stages. Primoz Roglic, there was a strange moment after the finish today when I was actually waiting for Max Poole, who was in the break today, and he was sort of gathering himself. He was tired and, as you would be after riding a 4,100 metres of altitude gain stage, he was gathering himself, and so I was sort of patiently waiting for him to do an interview, and I was told to come back in a couple of minutes. And then Primoz Roglic sort of appeared in front of me with my Slovenian colleagues, my colleagues from Slovenian TV. He always sort of seeks them out, or vice versa, and he does an interview with them before he speaks to anyone else. But I was the only journalist there wanting to speak to him in English, and we were sort of quite a long way from the finish line at this point, hence why I sort of had him trapped, and I asked him those three or four questions that you heard there, and I think the answers were slightly blunter than the answers he subsequently gave to other crews that you might have heard on the television coverage. And well, the message, loud and clear, Rob, is that Primoz Roglic doesn't necessarily... I mean, you tell me, Rob, what you took from those comments. My reading is that he's not necessarily in agreement with the decision that was taken last night in the meeting, this fabled meeting.
Well, in this Primoz and Freeboss world exclusive that you managed to secure, I'm in complete agreement. I wish I could say that I was flabbergasted, flummoxed. I don't think I am, though, because I think one thing that, you know, you can maybe level quite a few things with Primoz Roglic and Jonas Vingegaard after yesterday. However, I'm always grateful, and I think I'll be eternally respectful to Primoz Roglic for his honesty in a lot of answers that he gives. I know that he has this weird style of not saying much and, you know, giving it the whole... But you generally sort of get the gist of what he's saying. So I have to give him the kudos.
It's like a luxury... He's like a luxury Peter Sagan in some ways, isn't he? He's like a Waitrose Sagan in interviews.
Again, both of them never really said much, but when they did say things, I think they meant it. And that's the difference with a lot of different riders that you get and we get on interview. So first of all, kudos for being honest. Secondly, I completely agree that he obviously doesn't agree with it. I think it's difficult to read anything else into it, isn't it? Was it the right thing to say again? You know, I'm building him up for being honest. Maybe not the most intelligent thing to say. Is there something else going on? Will the Rog to leave Jumbo-Visma rumour mill start up again? And there's so much that we could read into this, and so much probably that us and colleagues will do over the next few months, given the fact that we might not have too much racing to talk about after the next 3 or 4 weeks are done. It's obvious that it's not all right. I mean, he did everything he needed to do on the road. Let's give him and Jonas Vingegaard the credit there. You know, there was no sort of moving from the message on the road this time, was there? But certainly away from it, you know, sowing the seeds of disquiet and showing us that it's not all as harmonious as the Jumbo-Visma spin machine would like us to believe.
Yeah, I mean, objectively, today was made into the general classification battle became quite boring because they did lock down the race. Jumbo-Visma locked down the race and sort of demonstrated exactly what they could, probably should have done a few days ago. And thinking about this last night and thinking about Primoz Roglic and the way he's ridden in his career, we sort of take it for granted now that this sort of new breed of rider is going to be an aggressive rider who will always ride to win. We've slowly seen the kind of an erosion of some of the canons of etiquette that used to prevail in the pro peloton. Things like, well, you know, I've got the leader's jersey, so you take the stage, or I've won three stages in this stage race, so I will let someone else win today. I won't sprint for the victory. And Roglic has been very much sort of emblematic of a new style of riding in which, okay, he's not necessarily the most aggressive in that he's not someone who will attack from, you know, kilometer zero, but he's very aggressive in taking everything, every prize that's available. And
he's done it all season, hasn't he? He's won every single stage race he started in, Daniel.
Yes. And seen in that light, his words yesterday, what we think were probably his feelings after that meeting, interpreted again through the interview we've just heard, is sort of coherent with who he has been throughout his career, which and that sort of style of racing and that attitude, and as I say, as a sort of modus operandi where the strongest rider, the best rider, the fastest rider does win, has made for some fantastic racing over the last few years, and better racing, let's face it, than what we saw today in the Grand Tour group. I mean, we used to be sick to the back teeth of these stages where the sort of overall general classification was in the bag for someone after a week or 10 days, and then they would effectively shut it down, neutralize it, particularly if they were as strong as this Jumbo-Visma team is in this race, because they could have shut this race down pretty much the day when Remco Evenepoel lost 27 minutes. And they dominated that stage on the Tourmalet as well. They have not done that, and in some respects we should be grateful that they haven't, because it's been an exciting Vuelta deep into the final week, which it probably wouldn't have been, having been billed as, well, we build it El Clásico, and it has been a bit of a classic, as I say, largely because of this sort of drama that's played out. But Rob, as our good friend, another Gore, Kierkegaard, that's probably a terrible pronunciation, the Danish writer, Søren Kierkegaard, famous writer, said, "And life can only be understood backwards, it must be lived forwards." Let's continue to try to understand what happened today and what is happening on this Vuelta a España by going back in time. Again, thinking about the context of, well, this morning, last night, the meeting that took place in the Jumbo-Visma camp, I thought it'd be interesting to hear from someone we don't ordinarily, or the sort of mainstream channels haven't been speaking to as much and hearing from as much. The Hungarian rider Attila Valter, he's riding his first Grand Tour for Jumbo-Visma. We have heard from him on a number of occasions on the cycling podcast. He's very eloquent, he's pretty honest at times, so I thought it'd be interesting to hear what he had to say about the prevailing wind in the Jumbo-Visma camp this morning. So here he was in Pola de Allende.
Attila, Richard Plugger told us there was a bit of a meeting last night. I don't expect you to tell us everything that happened, but how aware have you of all the conversation on in the public, and particularly social media, about the way the team rode yesterday, criticism of Jonas, of Primoz? How much are you following it?
Yeah, every rider, I think, follows it differently. Me and myself, I still do it a bit too much than I should, because normally it's not a good idea to do it. These guys are my friends, and I really like to work for them. So when they criticize them, it's just also I feel that I'm also criticized in a way. And it's just, I think, was people can have their own opinion, and it's okay to tell it. It's not a problem, and it's their right to feel what they feel. But it's not, I think, was a bit overpushed, this situation, at all, because Sepp just lost 18 seconds. He kept the jersey, and we just won the race. So that's our main goal. We are here to race against others, and on a 20% climb, I think it's really hard to make some philosophic questions to think about, as Primoz Roglic, like, should I do it, should I not? If you have the legs, this is a race. So I also understand, and he's a champion, and champions fight until the line, and that's how it goes. So yeah, it was a bit too much for me, the social media, but that's how it is.
It is confusing, and you're on a steep climb where the directors can't necessarily see the TV. But I guess people think, why isn't there a clear instruction just to wait for Sepp? Because the other guys, Ayuso, Mas, they're a long way out of the back now. And they could have done that yesterday. They could have waited for him, and then the three of them could have just sprinted, and Primoz could still have won the stage.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. And we had a clear decision, and the clear decision is that all these big champions, Jonas, Primoz, and now Sepp also, they are here to win this race. So it's really difficult to tell to a rider like Primoz Roglic, when he is able to win the race, that no, you cannot do that. So it's you know, it's not so easy having this luxury problem. I think it is a luxury problem that you want to have all your riders happy. And then I think they had a talk in the second race day, and everyone said, yeah, the strongest should win this race, and everyone is going for it, and that's what they did. So I really can tell you that there is no hard feelings in the bus. We are really so different than what the people imagine how is in the bus. So it's just it's nice in a way, and really I should put away my phone and just be with the guys, because we are all happy that we could win another stage. We can really control the race. We can really be always in the right moment, always in the right time. Not just them, but us helpers, we also, I think, doing a great work. So just enjoy these moments and not focusing on what people are saying about us when we are like 1-3 at the stage and still people fight us.
Last thing, Atali, you mentioned that decision on the rest day. Has that changed this morning, that the strongest man is going to win the race?
The strongest man is going to win the race, yeah. I think.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
So Rob, one might say in similar fashion to Primoz Roglic's interview this afternoon, that interview with Attila Valta ended on a tantalising note, in that he told me the strongest rider was going to win, was still going to win. And sort of suggesting that whatever decision was made on the second rest day, now you can already question whether the second rest day was maybe a bit too late to have these conversations. Maybe the start of this Vuelta a España was the time to decide what was going to happen. If, you know, it might not have been three riders, it might have been two, it might have been Vingegaard and Roglic if they were close together. However, he sort of suggested that they had stuck to their guns. Jumbo-Visma had stuck to their guns. That's if you really take what he said at face value. However, sort of reflecting on it now, I think maybe when Valter said the strongest man will win, what he wanted to say, what he was really saying, was that Sepp deserves this. And he has been pretty much the strongest rider, or close enough to be considered.
I thought he was the strongest rider on this stage today, actually. And I'll go back. I've re-watched in our little break. I've had a look back at the images that I talked about in the tail of the etapa with about a kilometre to go. And that Vingegaard gets on the radio when there's a small gap as Kuss is pushing on. And Kuss does lift up his foot for that little moment. I know then that Vingegaard goes on to lose, 9 seconds after that. But it did to me today look like, you know, if we're going down that road and sticking to that argument, that today certainly Kuss was the strongest of the three.
And Rob, we didn't discuss what Jonas Vingegaard did in the closing meters. Losing time, was that a diplomatic loss of time? Because, well, we're going to talk later on in the episode about what may occur on tomorrow's stage. And just thinking more about these stages that we have to come, you know, once it became clear, and we sort of read between the lines this morning that this decision had been taken by Jumbo-Visma, that they did want Sepp Kuss to win, it was almost the balloon of sort of wild conjecture and speculation. It was deflated a little bit, and everything maybe in some people's minds did start to feel like a foregone conclusion. However, it's really not a foregone conclusion, because all it needs is for someone to lose a wheel. Go back and look at the results of the last so-called processional stages of all Grand Tours, and look at how time gaps have innocuously opened up in those particular stages, purely because of that. Purely, you know, if you had someone who had taken a dislike to Sepp Kuss and wanted Jonas Vingegaard to win, all they would have to do is position themselves in front of Sepp Kuss in the peloton on the way into the finish line in Madrid and let a wheel go. So it's not a foregone conclusion. It's still not a foregone conclusion. So Jonas Vingegaard losing a little bit more time this afternoon, was that a further diplomatic gesture, move?
Was it, wasn't it?
I don't know, Rob. I don't know. You tell me.
I'm 50-50 on that, Daniel, because I'm convinced today that Vingegaard did make that message on the radio on the way in. However, the way that it looked, it might have looked like that in the last 500 metres once the next attack went. And again, I would say that it was the intelligent thing to do. If he was going to do that, and if he did want, if he's true to his word, I've said right at the start tonight that actions speak louder than words. You know, the words were all coming out last evening saying, no, but we want Sepp to win, and you had that sort of strange quote from Roglic, didn't you? But yeah, come on, mate, come on, we're all rooting for you. But, you know, he's 500 metres up the road looking back and saying that. Come on. I think it was a clever thing to do from Vingegaard, if it was intentional. Was it intentional? I'm not sure I can make a judgment on that, Daniel. But you're quite right about the, well, there's time bonuses, there's little splits. I mean, what if there's a split in the wind as well tomorrow? There's all sorts of things that can happen. What if there's, you know, an attack that needs to be covered on Saturday, even though I know it's not on paper the hardest stage in the world. But, and then like you say, you know, and that finish in Madrid in particular, when you come around the corner from Atocha and you're coming up to the finish there, it's a big, big 180 degree corner, isn't it, that? And it's quite easy for a wheel to open up there on the way in. We've seen it in many of Madrid's sprints at the end of the Vuelta.
Yeah, certainly 8 seconds was too close to comfort, I think. Mm. And if it was deliberate this afternoon by Jonas Vingegaard, I think it was probably wise. Rob, let's just shovel a few more coals on the already super caliente hot take machine, shall we? Again, going back to this morning, I thought it'd be interesting, and well, spoke to numerous riders this morning. I thought it would be interesting to hear what they had to say, the sort of outsiders, but within the peloton perspective of what was going on at Jumbo-Visma. I think there's a certain amount of schadenfreude, there's a certain amount of glee at seeing a dominant team suffer this sort of embarrassment of riches, these champagne problems. And, well, let's hear now from Geraint Thomas, shall we, who's uniquely placed and pretty well placed to comment on some of the difficulties that Jumbo-Visma are having, because of course Sky Ineos Grenadiers sometimes found themselves in a position where they had to make tough decisions like the ones Jumbo-Visma are confronted with at the moment. First we're going to hear Geraint Thomas reflect on his very ill-starred Vuelta, which continues to be pretty ill-starred, and then we discussed Jumbo-Visma and what occurred yesterday on the Angliru.
Tough, mate, to be honest. Like, since dropping out of GC was tough enough, and then obviously the crashes and struggling with my back a bit, with my rib, but yeah, it's just the way it is. But I'm sort of determined to finish now, at least not going to let the Vuelta break me.
Does it become just a point of pride, or are you still sort of, well, do you need this race, do you need to take something from this race, maybe, I don't know, for the end of the season or even for next year? Is it important for that reason?
I think I'd take a lot from it anyway, with having such a rubbish race. You know, it was similar to 21 in the Tour and then the Olympics, and it was a real depressing sort of end of the year that was. This year, obviously, I can still take success from it with the Giro and everything that I had at the start of the year, coming back from that. But it's certainly, I don't know, maybe it's the wrong thing, but my mindset's already on next year, really, and wanting to... You're already thinking about how to improve and what do better and what I want to do. Come to no conclusions at all, but that's the mindset I'm on. And I've still got 4 hard days racing, and try and help the team as best I can. You know, days like today is kind of limited a bit, but you know, with Pipo, you know, we've seen he's strong and he is quick. It's just something to go for. So yeah, that's our mindset now.
If you guys are getting a little bit, not upset, but you know, they're sort of saying, well, Jumbo, you know, they want to take everything, and then obviously we've had the drama playing out last night. Well, first of all, what did you make of that yesterday?
For a start, I got no issue with them trying to win every stage. Like, that's bike race, you know, it's a race, and you know, go for it if you got the legs and you want to do that. But when it comes to the race yesterday, it was, yeah, I was a bit bemused, to be honest. More in the fact Roglic has taken a lot of heat, but I think it's kind of agree with it, to be honest. Like, it's changing his position in no way. He's not going to win this Vuelta unless he puts a minute into Jonas today, which I can't see, but you never know. His third place is solid anyway. There was no need to continue. But the day before, same thing really. Jonas went early. Other teams were around, so they didn't pull behind, they didn't chase. For me, if you're going to say we race and the best guy wins, then do it. But when guys are kind of hampered and tactically, I think you can't do it then, if that makes sense, you know? Like, Primoz and Chris aren't going to chase Jonas with Ayuso and, you know, Siano and whoever in the wheel. So you're not really racing it, are you? You're kind of hampered by the tactics as well. I totally sympathise with the position they're in, because it's tough, because everyone wants to win, that's obvious. But I think the management need to be stronger in those situations, really. And for me, Kuss deserves it. I think we were chatting on the bus, and I think if a leader is stronger and his domestique has the jersey, I think for sure he should be allowed to go, because you can't gift a Grand Tour. That's too much of a gift. You know, there's a stage or whatever, but you don't just give someone a Grand Tour because he's worked for you for a long time, if you're better. But the point is, I don't think there is that much of a gap between them. Like, you look at yesterday, Kuss only dropped with a K before the top of the climb. Like, it's not that blatant in my eyes. And so, it's tough, innit? I really hope Sepp wins it, but yeah, we'll see what pans out today.
But it's kind of symptomatic a bit of the way cycling's changed over the last 10 years, hasn't it? We've slowly seen these old kind of canons about etiquette, you know, oh, I've got the jersey, so you win the stage. That kind of thing slowly sort of being phased out. And even like within teams, you know, this whole ethos that they've had over the last few days of everyone go for it, it's kind of, that is symptomatic of the way things have gone, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And then there's a lot of talk about like the respect in the peloton anyway, you know, and it's a bit weird, isn't it? Just getting photographed mid-chat. But yeah, just... like that is a big change in the peloton overall. The fact that everyone is, there is definitely a lot less respect, I feel, in the peloton, just with everything from coming into a corner and dive bombing each other, or, you know, yeah, just the etiquette of the race. And then obviously, yeah, as you say, with there's no real ranking, every man for himself type attitude. That's just the way it's gone, you know, and it's the way it is now, I think. But people can still, I feel like I still give people a bit of space and don't dive bomb them into a corner and have respect for guys around me. But most don't really.
Well, Rob, we've heard that before, haven't we? That respect, levels of respect in the peloton are not what they used to be. We've heard that from previous generations. Go back two generations, you hear it, you heard it about the last generation. So that's nothing new. But
Geraint, an hour a lad, is it? Eh?
No, exactly. But Geraint did. Well, we did touch there on something we've already mentioned in this episode, that some of these old canons are dissolving and they are falling by the wayside. And there's maybe also a question about generational change in society as well, and how this current generation, now Primoz Roglic is in his mid-30s, so he's, you know, he's a millennial,
He's not a Gen Z, a Zoomer. But this generation, if you take the peloton as a whole, how differently they just approach things in their lives and how they think about opportunity. We had Rolf Aldag on the podcast a few months ago talk about how this generation is much more motivated by opportunities than by money. You know, there may be a bit of that in this dilemma.
Perhaps, but I mean, it's not as if Vingegaard and Roglic are lacking opportunity, is it? I mean, Roglic has won 3 Vueltas, he's won the Giro for the first time this year. Vingegaard won the last 2 Tour de France. Plenty to come in the future. And I know that, yes, there's a counter argument to that and say careers are short and, you know, could fall off tomorrow and you know, that might be it, an injury, and you might end up not being at the same level. Look at Egan Bernal today, yet again. You know, he was going to dominate, wasn't he, for the next 10 years, and then he has this awful accident. More competition comes along and he himself is just struggling to stay out there in a breakaway. And obviously I know that a lot of people are hoping, and we're all hoping, I think, as fans, that he gets back to the same level. But it's a hard road back, and there might be people looking at that and saying, hang on, I've got to strike while the iron's hot here. This is an opportunity to win the Vuelta. It's natural that Vingegaard and Roglic, as the sort of GC machines that they are going to want to do that. But then there has to surely be the chat about this being a completely unique opportunity, if you want to go down that road and talk about opportunity for Sepp Kuss. And, you know, we could sit here all night talking about how he probably deserves it. There's also the argument that he's still up there and he's still strong. And, you know, the only time he wasn't able to react was when he was attacked by his own teammates, who shouldn't be doing that to him anyway. You know, I find it very, very strange that you know, they're unable to see this as a unique opportunity for Sepp Kuss. And one more point, Daniel, which I think is much more important to both Vingegaard and Roglic's opportunities themselves, to stay on this theme of opportunity. If Sepp Kuss is pissed off right now, sorry for the strong language, and, you know, if something like that happened to a lot of people, as nice as you are as a person, and it's nice to be nice, I think, you know, I think most normal people enjoy being nice, don't they, and helping others and doing that. And that's very much in Sepp Kuss's nature. But if you have your own mates who you've worked so hard for actively conspiring against you, as they were yesterday on the road, when they didn't need to do, again, racing situation is different. If someone attacks their follow, that's fine, that's racing. But what they did yesterday was just bizarre. And if that happens, then in the next 2-3 seasons, and Sepp Kuss is expected to still be at his very best, are you going to sweat every last drop of blood, sweat and tears for your mate's opportunity? I mean, you know, Vingegaard and Roglic could be putting in danger the chances to win the next 2 or 3 Grand Tours by doing this week.
Yeah. I differ from you slightly, Rob, and I have a slightly less conspiratorial view of, view what Roglic and Vingegaard did yesterday as slightly less conspiratorial. And to be honest, I blame the management.
Oh, but I mean, that's a given, isn't more, it? I mean, the management should be putting their foot down.
To a greater extent. And, you know, and if they're guilty of anything, I think it's of coming into this race with a slightly utopic view. And I talked about maybe this generation or another generation being more motivated by opportunities than money. I think their naivety was that you could give all 3 riders all of the opportunities that they wanted and that everyone would leave happy. And as I said to Lionel yesterday, or as Lionel and I said, sort of, you know, with Primoz clutching his Star Wars figure and Jonas with his Sabutio, and I don't know what Sepp might...
That was the thing, Ollie's birthday as well. I mean, come on, guys.
Yeah, it's Mr. Frosty. Slush puppy maker. I think that was naive, and I think, you know, as I said on Twitter, if it's still called that, this morning, they're smart people, and they wouldn't be where they are if they weren't smart. And I think they will have realised that they have made certain mistakes, and they will probably correct course. However, Rob, just one last question on this before we move on. On Sunday, in all likelihood, Sepp Kuss, he will go up on the podium, he'll take his red jersey, Primoz Roglic will be standing on one side, Jonas Vingegaard will be on the other side of him. There will be confetti, there will be kava. Sepp Kuss will probably be drunker than he was a few days ago when he overindulged on the kava post-stage. Will any of this matter then? And will it matter in the sort of rear view mirror as we go into the winter and as we start to hand out prizes and gongs and accolades? Will all of this be forgotten? Because it feels as though this has been a long running saga and an explosive saga, but the news agenda and our own sort of personal news agendas move on very, very quickly. Will this just be a blip?
It's funny, I was on a bike ride.
Has it tarnished the whole thing?
I was on a bike ride around these wonderful Asturian hills this morning, and it's exactly the thing that I was thinking of. My view was, as a fan, obviously, when I'm commentating on air, I'm not going to be expressing my own opinion, so a very, very rare opinion coming out here. As a fan, what happened yesterday sort of spoils it for me because it changes the way that, you know, in all this sort of stressing of, you know, we don't want to gift anything, there's no gifts. After yesterday, it does look rather strange, doesn't it? With the margin of victory, the way it happened, attacking your mates and all the sort of confused messages that came out. For me, it's not going to be something that's forgotten quickly. I know that the news agenda moves and it's not going to be at the front forefront of our mind. I can't imagine myself introducing one of the early races next season and it being the first or only topic of conversation. But I think it's something that fans probably won't forget when they look, and I know, you know, not many people support teams, do they? And we probably, I think a lot of us like cycling because there isn't that sort of mega fandom we find in other sports and almost sort of tribal mentality. I think we quite enjoy it because there's not that. But, you know, people who are going down that road are maybe going to look differently on Jumbo-Visma after that, especially, as you said, the management, because in the heat of battle, I know we can be disappointed in what the riders did on one day, but yes, there's always that excuse, isn't there, that, you know, in the heat of the moment, things happen. But the management, I think, have to really, really take a lot of responsibility. And I'm not sure, if I'm completely honest, Daniel, that I will have the same feeling that I would have had looking at the podium had yesterday not happened like that. Again, I'll stress that one thing is reacting to a racing situation. And let's say that another dangerous rider had been up there in that group. Of course, they have to ride. That's racing. And if Kuss can't keep up, then of course he can't keep up. Another thing is looking behind, as Jonas Vingegaard did, seeing Sepp Kuss there and continuing to ride with Primoz Roglic, who'd obviously put his pace on. That, for me, leaves a really bitter taste in the mouth.
Well, Rob, the sun is setting over the Asturian mountains. The beat is still thumping from the press buffet DJ. I wonder if this will become a permanent fixture at press buffets at Grand Tours. I kind of hope it does. Rob.
As long as the food's still good, yeah.
Yes, yes. Rob, Sepp Kuss is still in the red jersey. What does that mean? You know what that means, don't you?
What does it mean?
That my fanciful, whimsical, ridiculous
mini series
about major tours and grand tours. Freebus's theorem that
who's next on the Aussie?
Well, that in future, all riders aspiring to wheel major tours will only ride major tours because that is the only preparation that will get them ready to win another one. That is my theorem. It's already been shot down by a couple of team coaches in the last 2 days. I vowed that as long as Sepp Kuss is in the red jersey, we're going to have someone else holding forth on it every day. Today, Rob, it is the turn of our good friend, our old friend, the Motown maestro, Lucky Larry Warbass of AG2R Citroën. And this conveniently also meshes with another regular feature that we have here on El Clásico.
Arriba, Larry Warbass. Andale, andale.
I've got a crackpot theory that Sepp's ridden 3 Grand Tours this year. Now, specificity in training is a principle that some coaches believe strongly in.
Yeah.
And in cycling, it's kind of a paradox that you guys do 1 week stage races, Grand Tours, 1 week, I'm sorry, 1 day races. I put it to you, Larry Warbass, that in the future, everyone who's a Grand Tour specialist is going to just do Grand Tours. I've spoken to various coaches about this. They've shot me down.
Yeah.
I want a rider's take, please.
I mean, I'd probably be on the coach's side. You know, I think the other thing we have to look at is also, like, mental fatigue, too, you know?
That's what they've said.
I mean, the other thing is, I would say most teams don't have the liberty
to just put guys in all three Grand Tours. You know, I think, you know, in a lot of teams, you know, they want to give young guys a chance, you know, for the Vuelta, things like that. They, you know, they want to give other guys, you know, chances to do the Grand Tours. So I think based on planning like that, and I think, you know, if you really, really train specifically for a Grand Tour, you know, the other thing that probably helps Sepp is, like, he lives at, I don't know, 1,600 meters or something like that. So he's always training at altitude. He's always living at moderate, low to moderate altitude. And, you know, yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, maybe they'll be more open to it, that's for sure.
Because, I mean, you guys generally, I said the other day on the podcast, you guys train in sort of 3-day micro blocks often, don't you? And it's sort of 3 days on, 1 day kind of off-ish. I would say that's relatively common in the peloton.
Yeah.
Are you not training for, you're not training yourselves for 3-day efforts effectively? And are you not getting it all wrong?
I mean, I've also asked myself this question, like, you know, usually after a Grand Tour, I'm flying. You know, I have probably some of my best form ever. And I'm like, why don't we try to mimic Grand Tours in training? You know, I often ask the question. But, you know, I think it's probably because it's really hard to control that fatigue. And, you know, with 3-day block, you know, 3-day blocks, you know, now I think a lot of teams, you know, are moving to 2-day blocks as well. I guess you could probably train harder in those 2 or 3 days than otherwise. So, yeah, I don't know. It's hard. I think it's just probably a question of, like, balancing fatigue and things like that.
I feel as though I'm convincing you. Larry, last thing. I put it to you that Sepp Kuss is in this position, but people are saying it's in spite of having done 2 Grand Tours. How about, well, what if we consider that it's because of having done 3 Grand Tours? I mean, you know what, like you just said there, what a Grand Tour gives you. There are things that these Grand Tours will have given Sepp Kuss that people in the peloton who have not done 2 Grand Tours this year won't have, physiologically, that they will have given him capacities that other people have not trained to the same extent this year.
I mean, yeah, I would say maybe it hasn't hurt him, but maybe it hasn't helped him either. You know, I would say maybe he's about even because of it. But, you know, I think the thing is on a team like Jumbo, they know exactly how you need to train and how you get ready for a Grand Tour. And I think if he focused all his energy on the Vuelta, maybe he would be better than he is, even better than he is because he's already quite good. But maybe also the fact that he probably came here like whatever. You know what I mean? Like it's not like he had a huge amount of pressure to perform because they were probably like, well, you know, it's your third Grand Tour. Like, I'm sure you'll be good. Just do your job, you know? And then he had really no stress or no pressure, whereas like if he only did 1 Grand Tour in the year, he would have a lot more pressure. So I would say like this mental aspect probably plays a lot bigger part in it.
Rob, as the days go by, I feel as though I'm brainwashing. I'm starting to brainwash the whole peloton, the whole professional cycling movement. I think by the time we get to Madrid, everyone will be convinced. And I'll be driven into the center of Madrid in a chariot, wearing a laurel wreath, and I'll be hailed by everyone as a revolutionary.
I can imagine you there at Cibeles. There'll be free boss scarves wrapped around the statue when they're celebrating your next Grand Tour title. On that, I wonder if, I mean, mathematicians, we should get mathematicians out there looking to see if they can find an algebra equation for your free boss's theorem. I really want to know how it all comes to the Grand Tours together. I want to see that written down in proper style.
I have to tell you as well, the conversation with Larry continued after the recording was stopped. And by the end of it, he was out of sorts, Rob. He rode off. He was sort of scratching his head. He didn't know what to think anymore. He was questioning his very existence by the end of our conversation this morning. Rob, let's find out what we've got tomorrow, shall we?
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Rob, off you go.
It's not done yet, is it? And I know that people will be thinking, what's he on about? It's a flat transitional stage. But we know, Daniel, that on the Vuelta, when we go through Castilla on either side of Madrid, whether it be La Mancha in the south or León in the north, the wind often blows. And I've just checked the wind forecast for tomorrow, And in the final hour and a half or so of racing on our way to Iskar, it's 177 kilometers tomorrow. No King of the Mountains climbs in there. A little bit of up and down on the Spanish Meseta on the little tabletop right in the center of Spain.
Little tabletop.
Watch out for the wind.
It's the biggest tabletop in the world.
In the world, yeah. Well, we like a big meal here, I guess. So, yeah, on the big tabletop, the biggest tabletop in the world. That's better, isn't it? Always at roughly altitude, what is it, 500, 700 metres, something like that, isn't it, along the way. The forecast isn't that for too much wind at the start, Daniel. So don't, when you switch on the telly in the morning or you turn up for the start, don't be too disappointed. But by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, all the way through to just before six when we expect the finish, the wind is going to be blowing from the right-hand side, right across, 90 degrees across the road. Around 20 to 25 kilometres per hour is the current forecast. So, even if you've got top three on GC, if you miss a split and Mikel Landa's in it, I know it might be fanciful, but this is Landismo's home, let's not forget, on this podcast. If Juan Ayuso's in it, if someone else's in it and they take a gap, you just never know. So, not expecting things, as we never do on these stages, but as I think we know, Daniel, that in Castellón, people always expect wind. And once the chatter goes around, once everybody's on the velo viewer and they're seeing the forecast, it can be sometimes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, can't it? Everyone's told to move.
You just have to think
there's
wind.
There's a lot of riding that's done. And then if you think wind,
if you think about wind,
the wind happen.
If you think about wind, then it just self, it just manifests, doesn't it, Rob? That's how it works in cycling. Rob, well, Cedar Quickstep will be delighted if it's windy tomorrow, won't they? They'll be delighted this evening. Fantastic performance by Remco Evenepoel. Rob, I'm going to indulge the listeners with a tip for tomorrow. I'm going to tip the young British rider who's riding for Groupama FDJ at this Vuelta a España, Luis Askey, who is in the break today. And, well, there's an ulterior...
Good classics rider.
Very good classics rider, good sprinter. There is, though, an ulterior motive for tipping him tomorrow. It gives us an excuse to hear from him today because, as I said, he was in the break. Another young British rider, very, very promising British rider, was in the break today. Max Poole of DSM Firmenich. And he, Rob, well, he was the sort of best of the rest when Remco set off on his solitary raid. The foot of the Cruz de Linares climb the first time around. He didn't finish second, did he, Max Poole? He was fourth in the end, am I right?
He was fourth, yeah.
He was fourth.
Yeah.
So we're going to play out tonight and by hearing from both of those two guys, I think we're going to hear Max Poole first and Luis Askey second. Rob, it's been a delight and you might be joining us again before the end of the Vuelta. Let's hope so.
Thank you, Daniel.
It was nice to try and hang with him for a bit, but yeah, he just went super fast and I think the best rider won today. So yeah, I mean, I had a tricky first couple of weeks to be honest, and I felt good this week so far. It's a positive, and I think we also kind of expected it coming in. Normally I get better as the race goes on, so. It's nice to be able to race a bit, especially in the final week after the tough first two weeks. So
just a quick one, Max. Just that moment where Remco sort of went away at the bottom of this climb the first time around. Was it important then not to try too hard to follow him and to keep something in the tank?
Yeah, maybe in hindsight, yeah, but not in the moment. I felt okay up the first time, and I don't see why I should have held back. I think it was the toughest part of the climb, it got to be easy, so I just tried to get over that bit. And of course, in the end I couldn't stick with him, and maybe it bites me in the bum a bit at the end, but I just tried to go with him.
Talked a couple of days ago about the difficulty of some days having to look for a focus, really. You had one today, you're in the break. How was it?
Yeah, I mean, the plan was to obviously have Lenny or Michael in the breakaway, so we didn't really, me and Lorenzo didn't really want to be there. We did want to be there, but we wanted to have one of them two with us. So, but it kind of, I was really expecting a long fight for the breakaway today, because we predicted that they were going to let Jumbo were going to let it for the breakaway for the win. But in the end, we were well placed at the bottom of the first little descent, and then kind of just rolled off the front, and like me and Lorenzo didn't pull a turn for the first 10-15k because we were hoping it was going to come back, but in the end it was like, what could we do? Like once you've got a gap on that sort of road, then yeah, it was finished. So yeah, it was a nice day out in front, but yeah, obviously if we had Michael or Lenny in the front, it could have been a really good day for them, so a little bit of a shame.
And I didn't catch up with you yesterday, Lewis, at the top of the Angliru, and we talked a bit about it in the preceding days. How was it in the end?
I mean, a bit of a shame, actually, because it was obviously so foggy up top, but maybe that was actually nice, because them last couple of kilometres, I think if it was... I'm assuming you can see normally when it's not foggy straight in front of you or just a wall, so maybe it was actually a blessing that it was so foggy. But yeah, it was a brutal climb, and in the end, the time limit was easy on that day, so I don't know what I was so worried about.
Ride it blindfolded next time.
Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.